Hello, everybody. My name is Ming Chen from AMC's Comic Book Man, and you're listening to We Be Geeks.
This episode of We Be Geeks is brought to you by Audio Technica. Marty, Jules, you guys have been happy with y'all's mics, right?
Yeah, we sound a whole lot better since we got our new mics. At least I have. I don't know about you, Jules. How about you?
I think I have. I don't know. I haven't listened to myself, but I like it. Pretty cool.
Well, if you're interested in getting to podcasting, or you're just looking for some really good headphones, because I tell you, I'm using the Audio Technica M50X, and they sound awesome. They really do. Check out their logo. Click on it on the homepage of WeBeGeeks.net. Takes you right to their shop. Microphones, headphones, all your audio and listening needs. All right there. So check them out. That's Audio Technica. And welcome to another edition of We Be Geeks. It is Marty and Jules, along with myself, Mike. And been a pretty busy week since last week.
Yeah, and the Trinity has reunited, too.
Yes. Yeah, that was, Stephen Byrne that did that?
Yeah, I saw that, and I was like, oh, that's us. Like, he must know us. I was going to put, like, how does he know what we look like? Because that is so us.
It was, if you missed it, follow one of us on Twitter, and Jules tweeted out this pretty sweet-looking drawing that was done of Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman, but kind of like in a modern day realistic sort of garb, like, you know, shirt, pants, jackets, you know.
I almost want to get him on Twitter and ask, can we use that as our cover photo for Facebook?
Because that's it. And then like put our silly mugs on their faces.
No, just leave it as is.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's probably better. That would probably look better. Otherwise, it would look really weird.
Yeah, because if we really alter it, man, Batman's all of a sudden got a gut.
Well, I was going to say, you wouldn't look so good on Wonder Woman's body, so that would
be. Yeah,
let's not change it.
So Marty, you were just at a convention this past weekend.
I did. It wasn't really kind of a fully planned out convention kind of trip. It was just sort of one of the guys from the comic shop said, hey, there's a show this weekend, let's go. And so we went for like a day trip. It was from Nashville to Lexington. It was like 3 hours. So we drove up there and drove back in the same day. So, I mean, total time, we were probably there like 6 hours at the show. But Lexington Comic Con, got to check it out. And pretty cool con they got going on. It's very very Power Rangers centric, because the guy that runs it, his son was like a huge Power Rangers fan, so they, you know, that's kind of a main focus thing. But they also have like pretty big contingency of wrestlers, pretty good contingency of just fan, you know, sci-fi and everybody else there. So ran into one of our previous guests, Gigi Edgley, at the show, and she said hi and would love to come back on and visit when hashtag is almost in is ready for release. So
cool.
So that was cool. And
it's always great when they want to come back to us and we're not having to.
She remembered us. That was nice. You know, sometimes people, maybe they're playing nice, but she did remember us. So
technical glitches and all.
Yeah, exactly. We joked about that. I got my final original Star Trek cast member autograph that I needed. That was living, at least. And, you know, Walter Conning was there, so I got Chekhov's autograph. And he's an old man, not super personal. Tried to strike up a conversation with him, but I don't think he was really interested.
Well, so. he was doing this one. Can't remember the name of the series now, but with Ellen Dubin.
Oh,
I can't think of it. But
yeah, got me on that one.
Yeah, because I remember Ellen talking about it.
Okay, I mean, he kind of seems like the guy that when you get to know him, he's pretty personable. But I don't think convention. I won't say con in a Star Trek sense, but I don't think convention Walter is super super chatty. Not compared to, you know, some of the other people there. But yeah, it was a pretty cool con. I posted. Like my favorite costumes that I saw at the show. There was one person that had like a full on, you know, metal Dalek from Doctor Who. And the best part was as it's rolling through the convention aisle, somebody goes, "Nice costume." And and then in that like creepy metallic Dalek voice going, "What's a costume?" And I was like, that somebody knows their character pretty well there. And yeah. then my other favorite was the I don't know if you've seen the Bombshell DC Girls that Aunt Lucia did, but somebody actually did a really nice job of replicating a Poison Ivy Bombshell.
Oh, that's cool.
So I didn't stick around for the costume contest. I had to get back home after a while, and it was later that night. But cool show floor. I have realized that I get this weird con anxiety, I guess you could say, where I need to know the layout. I need to explore before I really feel comfortable with the show. And so by the time I got comfortable, it was almost the end of the show. So I think like... And I noticed that like Wizard World and like C2E2, like the same thing where it's like, I need to figure out where everything's at, and then I can figure out what I want to do.
Right.
And doing a one day show like that doesn't exactly allow that. So, but yeah, no, I had definitely a good time.
Nobility is the show I'm thinking of.
Nobility. Yeah. I was trying to think of like the other,
Doug Jones is in it. Ellen's in it. Okay. Adrian Wilkinson. Those big.
Another guest of the show that we've had on before, Jake Lloyd was at the show, but I just missed him. Like, he went back to go, you know, take a break and at his booth. And so I just missed seeing him, but so I didn't get to say hey to him. But,
I know what you're saying about wanting to get the layout. I mean, when I go MegaCon, you know, first day, yeah, they're open 1 to 7. Usually, you know, get there, get the tickets in advance, you get in an hour early. So 12 to 7. I'm usually there like 12 to 5, 12 to 5:30. One, partially because with iDrive, I know what the traffic's like. Two, it's more to just go, okay, let's figure out where everyone is. If there's something I really gotta have, I'll take care of it first day, but let's get lay of the land. Like this year, I'll try and hit up Jimmy and Amanda, because I've got that Valentine's special blank cover of Harley that I would love to see if Amanda would do a sketch on it, which I have something in mind, but I would love for, well, it doesn't have to be full figures, but I would love to get the bust of almost like a selfie shot of Starfire, Power Girl, and Harley, since Amanda's doing.
That's cool. I was just thinking, I want to call it a negative to the show, because it's not really a negative, but it's like my own personal preferences. Like, they had the large convention room, they had most of the vendors in the middle, and then the media guests were sort of did this U along the edges of the room, and sometimes it did feel like the aisles were a little narrow. And so, you know, especially at the media guests, because the media guests would have people kind of standing around wanting to maybe talk, or you know, lines might be forming. And then you got the booths right next to them, to where, you know, people are just trying to look at knickknacks and stuff. And then they must have had an overflow of vendors. So they ended up having, there's, I guess, three floors to this convention center. So the bottom floor had the main section. And then you go up to the third floor to buy your tickets. And then there was another, like, sort of like overflow room of vendors. And then you also had your two or three different main halls for panels and things like that. So, you know, getting the layout was weird, and then the whole layout for the upstairs vendor room was actually like really wide aisles and really spaced out properly, and it felt, you know, felt like a good size show. Of course, they could probably afford to have that much extra space for the people, but
right.
So that, I thought that was just a unique way to do it, interesting way to do it.
Yeah. Is this your first time at this show?
Yeah, I hadn't been to the show before. I'd heard about it all the time, and I knew it wasn't that far away. I think next year, if I do it, that I'd go the night before and spend the night, because by the time we left here pretty early in Nashville, but by the time, you know, you gas up, you get something to eat, you hit the road, you know get to the show and stuff like that, time change, because we're in Central and they're in Eastern, it was like 1 o'clock before I'm walking in the door to the show. So you know, that takes most of the time exploring out. So that was like, but that's nothing on the convention itself. That was just what we did ourselves, make it a day trip.
Okay.
But their guest list, their media list is actually really stout for a show that's, it's a show that's still up and coming, because it's only like a few years old. But they do a pretty spectacular job of at least attracting different genres of people to come to the show and check it out and see, have a good time. A lot of good cosplay. I lost count of how many Harley Quinns and Deadpools after like the first hour. There needs to be a meter or a check mark or a bingo game with, you know, know, how many Deadpools have you seen? How many Harleys?
It gets to a point, it's like, you almost have to go, yeah, there's just too many to count.
Yeah, Harley, Deadpool. So, you just yell it out. That's all you start doing.
Yeah, it's like yelling back scratcher.
Yeah, exactly.
You want to get a whole section of convention floor going, just start yelling back scratcher.
I did see, I know what it was. One of the funny moments was I was going, I think, up to the upstairs convention, and coming in to the main floor was like three of the Power Rangers. And I think we had a discussion on the show about like, I really only know the original cast after that. It kind of gets right. Fuzzy. So two of them were kind of like replacement cast from the original cast, and I kind of recognized them. But then I noticed like that darted in front of me really quickly was this dude, and it took me about 10 or 15 seconds to process, like, holy crap, that was the original, you know, Black Power Ranger. And then holy crap, that dude was short, because he only came up, granted I'm a tall guy, but he really only came up to like my chest, like, wow. If that, like I'm talking he might be 5'5", might be.
Wow.
I was really surprised at like how tiny this dude was.
Camera angles were good to him.
So now it makes me want to go back and look, because, you know, I think the Pink Ranger wasn't that tall either, so, but maybe they're actually closer in height than I realized when I was watching the show.
Well, I'll tell you, while you were at the convention, DC had a busy weekend.
Oh, yeah?
Started off Friday with the debut of the variant cover for Batgirl for the upcoming Joker month. To me, it's a great-looking cover. Kind of a nod back to Killing Joke. But apparently, that wasn't a problem, because somebody or some group or people in general just can't appreciate the nod, and this is just way too sensitive of subject matter to be putting on a cover. Come on, it's Joker. Look at the history, especially with Killing Joke, that was there between Joker and Batgirl. I understand she's got a new look. I understand he has a new look, but it's still a great nod. Killing Joke. Hey, have you guys seen the cover?
Mm-hmm. I have, because Twitter practically exploded with it, if you follow, you know, and about half a dozen of the creators out there in the world. I know, very vocal. I think Mark Wade got very vocal in going on some stances on it. Gail Simone, I saw tweeting some things. You know, it was quite, you know, quite a few of the comic pros had an opinion, or at least retweeting different opinions about it. Maybe not. I don't know if I per se saw their opinion of it, but I don't know. Yeah. I'm curious. What was your thought of it, Jules? Did you get to see the image?
Yeah, I did. Before I saw the image, though, I had saw tweets about it without even seeing it. So my take on it was a little different, because the tweets that I were seeing, I guess, was that, you know, basically it's I don't know the correct word, an innuendo for what happened between Joker and Batgirl, like the look on her face, why she's so terrified, and that people are relating to this in a different way. So before I even seen it, I was like, you know, I guess kind of thinking, okay, I can kind of understand where people are coming from with this. And then, of course, I had to go on Twitter and see, you know, because all you had to do was type in Batgirl and it came right up. So I saw a lot of, it was like 50-50, you know, a lot of people that I was following were upset about it. A lot of the people that I was following were saying, hey, it's art, it's a cover, you know.
It's important to note, it is a variant cover. So this wouldn't be the cover that was going to be on every issue of Batgirl. It was going to be like the 1 in 25 variant or something like that.
Yeah, this was going to be one that was going to be valued around $50 if you wanted this cover.
Maybe, yeah. It just depends on how rare. I don't know how many they were going to do for the Batgirl.
I think it was like 1,000.
I guess one like thing about it is that even me, myself included, people don't like, you know, Batgirl is a strong kick butt female character. And I guess, like, you know, we don't want to see her like that, I guess, is one of the takes on it. You know, especially even, like, you know, even though younger kids probably aren't reading Batgirl right now, younger girls probably aren't reading that right now. My daughter doesn't read it. But, you know, if they did see that, well, why is Batgirl, like, what's going on there? You know, like, I guess making the reference to that is probably the other side to that, is why people were kind of upset about that.
So for those that may have not have seen it, like, just kind of a quick description of it, it essentially, you know, it's an homage to The Killing Joke. You've got the Joker with his purple hat on. Most of his face is kind of in shadows, but he's standing right next to Barbara Gordon, Batgirl, arm around her with a gun pointing down. The arm that's around her has a gun in his hand, and it's pointing downward. And then you have Batgirl just with this sheer terror look on her face, and I think even a tear like boiling up in one of the eyes. And you can just tell, like, she knows, she either knows something bad is coming or something has just happened, to one of those kind of illusions. So I know that's, you know, I showed it to a couple people and I was like, hey, you know, a couple people that knew comics and a couple people that didn't. And, you know, the couple people that didn't know comics were also kind of that, you know, they're that sort of activist or hippie kind of mentality, I guess you could say. Where it's like, I knew if this was an image that was easily said to be derogatory or you know, shows a lot of violence, that they would get it right away. And you know, the couple people I showed was like, oh, that's a really creepy image, but they didn't associate it with any, you know, violence or anything like that. They just said it was really creepy and they couldn't place exactly why. And then afterwards I told them, oh, well, it's, you know, if you put it in context with this story that happened like 20 years ago, where this Joker did this and this and this to Barbara Gordon, and a couple of these things were alluded to, then how does that change your opinion on the story or this image? And I'm like, oh yeah, I could, okay, that makes sense as to why she's got that face, why she's terrified, why she's crying, why the gun over her shoulder, you know, could be holding her hostage to this. And it made sense within that context, but outside of that context, it didn't seem like as bad as what the world was making it out to be.
Right. Well, I guess, according to Comic Book Resources, which is where I've been keeping track of everything with this for my own personal viewing entertainment, I guess, best way to put it. Multiple websites ran editorials critical of the image, and hashtag change the cover drew dozens of posts on Twitter and Tumblr asking DC not to release the variant. In DC's official statement on the situation, it's indicated that threats of violence and harassment were made following the release of the image. Really, folks? It's a cover.
Well, it's kind of ironic that threats of violence were thrown about a cover that they were upset about because it was showing depicting violence. And I'm like, wait a minute, that's
hypocritical. Raphael Albuquerque, his release was, my Batgirl variant cover artwork was designed to pay homage to a comic that I really admire and I know is a favorite of many readers. The Killing Joke is part of Batgirl's canon, and artistically, I couldn't avoid portraying the traumatic relationship between Barbara Gordon and the Joker. For me, it was just a creepy cover that that brought up something from the character's past that I was able to interpret artistically. But it has become clear that others, it touched a very important nerve. I respect these opinions, and despite whether the discussion is right or wrong, no opinion should be discredited. My intention was not to hurt or upset anyone through my art. For that reason, I have recommended to DC that the variant cover be pulled. I am incredibly pleased that DC Comics is listening to my concerns and will not publish the cover art in June as previously announced. DC's official statement was, we publish comic books about the greatest heroes in the world and the most evil villains imaginable. The Joker variant covers for June are a recognition of the 75th anniversary of the Joker. Regardless of fans like Raphael Albuquerque's homage to Alan Moore's The Killing Joke graphic novel from 25 years ago, or find it inconsistent with the current tonality of the Batgirl books, threats of violence and harassment are wrong and have no place in comics or society. We stand by our creative talent, and per Raphael's request, DC Comics will not publish the Batgirl variant.
Yeah, I know the one of the current writers on the Batgirl book didn't want to have the cover on there too. He was a pretty big opponent against it.
I'm just curious. And, what did Gail say about it? Was she for it?
I actually never saw her. I don't think I ever saw like her actual opinion of it. Like I said, I saw a lot of creators doing retweets and stuff, and a lot of them were started getting into a whole censorship debate, which is always fun to read on Twitter in 140 characters at a time,
right?
But because nobody can really flesh out what exactly they're saying. thing, and it always gets misread. But so that's where I came in. Like, I came in at the tail end. I'm like, what? The crap just blew up, and instead it was, you know, just talking about a cover on a comic book. You know, I had to go another hour into my timeline or so.
Yeah, unfortunately, with Gale, it's gonna be a lot of scrolling.
But it is kind of a tough call because I can understand what they're saying as far as, you know, how it feels like it does depict, but it also, to me, you know, just looking at it, that might be like one of the creepiest covers I think I've ever seen, and it's really kind of stuck with me. But I'm not saying, like, I'm not glorifying it or I'm not doing it. I was just saying, like, that is a creepy cover. Right. And that was the artist's intention. He wasn't trying to do anything else. I don't believe. He's a really well-known artist, and he does a lot of great work, and he's never gone over that line before. So I don't think his intention was ever glorify violence against women, or, you know, because, you know, even in the story, there's allusions to the Joker possibly having even raped Barbara Gordon. So there's, you know, there's connections to that people have. So
I think one of the other things that I had seen on Twitter was that people were saying that you never see the reverse of this. Like, you never see a male in this situation. Like, it's always the female that's in this. So I think it was more...
Getting into the girlfriend in the fridge debate.
Right. It was hitting a personal note on some levels, that, you know, why is it always the female superhero that's getting whatever this is, you know? So, I mean, that's just what I had seen. Like, there was a, like, at least three or four different, like, thoughts on, you know, the cover. Mm-hmm. I think it's a hard thing, because you don't want to say, you know, you don't want to tell people, I mean, this is art. You don't want to tell people, oh, you know, once you start doing that, then there nobody can do art, you know, like,
right.
So, but on the other hand, you have to, I don't know, it's a tough thing.
I would hate to be in the shoes and have to make that decision, because to me, when I, you know, I heard about the outroar of it first, and then I saw the image, and to be honest with you, I was like, wait, that's the image that everybody's complaining, you know, because especially at first glance, it looks like nothing. You just see two people kind of standing next to each other until you look closer at it and you start, you know, really connecting what the art's telling you. And then it's like, oh, okay, there's a lot more going on in this than first glance. But I, you know, honestly, when I clicked on the image, I really thought, I expected there to be something really messed up on here for the amount of uproar that it was causing.
Yeah, I mean,
something really, I mean, just like messed up. And I've seen some messed up, stupid stuff in comics.
I'm sorry. I mean, to me, the only other thing that recently has popped up with DC that has been as controversial and really didn't go much anywhere was from the issue one of Harley Quinn with the whole bathtub, you know, killing, supposedly trying to kill her in the bathtub. You know, that was left in. And, you know, people... I'm still flabbergasted. Threats of violence. I mean, really?
But it's violence written on Twitter, so how scared could they be?
True.
Where 2 days later, they'll be violent about something else and have forgotten all about cover. So it's... I don't know.
Yeah, I don't get the whole violence thing. That makes no sense.
I mean, who would really take the time and go, if you do this, I'm going to come up there and beat you guys up. Okay, fine. And then you're just proving the point, and we're releasing the cover. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
So
it's one thing to have an adult conversation about it over social media or over anything. You know, that's one thing. But I feel like with social media too, like if this would have been published, or if this cover would have been, you know, put out, like, you know, when social media didn't even exist or wasn't so big that it would still be published.
That was one that's the debates I even saw was kind of the whole why is the minority being the controlling what the majority wants, like, how, you know, okay, it does look like Twitter is exploding with this, but how much of that is actually, you know, readership of what we're doing as a community, as an art form, as a business, comics, like, how many of these people were going to buy Batgirl anyways or buy this cover anyways, you know? So how does that really affect us? Because it can look like there's a lot of people that are really mad about it on Twitter when really the pie is just a sliver.
True. Well, right. To me, the other thing is, I mean, we're talking social. I'm sorry. Take social. Yes, I understand social media has gotten to a point where it's responsible for cyberbullying and, you know, people wanting to commit suicide, whatnot, because they can't take it. You know what? You know how you handle the bullies? Stop going to Facebook. Stop going to Twitter.
Or just block them, delete them.
Exactly. You can block, delete. I mean, ignore them. They will go away. If they don't, hello, call your local police department or law enforcement. They will look into it and take care of it. No big deal. I mean, and to be that influential on art and that cover, yes, it's a great homage to the Killing Joke. I don't think it needs to disappear. I would still, I mean, is it something that right now I'm going to hang up on the wall if that print was ever released? No, because my daughter is just a little too young for it. Now, as she gets older and she understands more, maybe. But
yeah, that was the viewpoints I was thinking too, because my daughter is a big comic book fan, and you know, I'm thinking to myself, if say we did buy this comic and we have it in the house, and she just randomly looks at comics sometimes, she'll just like, we'll get our bag of comics and she's looking for Hooker in there, you know, and if she sees this, like, is she gonna think anything? Like, what is she gonna think about this? Like, so that's, you know, it's just something that just me as a parent, I worry about everything. It doesn't even have to be this cover, it could be anything, and I'm like, wait, she can't see that we have sex criminals in our bag. No, it's not just the art, it's just like anything that is not, I guess, appropriate, but you know, that I think she might read into or think something, you know, that I'm like, wait, we can't, you know. That's just me being a overprotective. Choose actually, well, I'll say mild in certain instances compared to probably some of the other things, but she actually probably would love Chew because she likes stuff like that. But yeah, it's just, I don't know, it's a
tough call, and it's I think part of it may be because the image itself, it doesn't, or it's say like you're standing there and you have a circle around you, and in that circle is like the safe zone or the PC zone or what, however you want to call it, like that, the socially acceptable zone. And then you step out of that, and that's the non-socially. It feels like it's got its foot out of the zone, but it hasn't quite placed it on the other, you know, the outside of that circle. So it's like really hard to gravitate to like say like, yeah, this probably shouldn't happen, or you know, no, it should. You know, it's hard to go either way and have, at least to me, have that strong argument, because I could see both sides of this argument. You know, it's also one of those things of just put it out there. If it sells, great. If it doesn't, then you just don't do it again.
Yeah.
You know, commerce is the greatest thing to shutting down something too. So yeah. Vote with your almighty dollar.
True. Yeah. Well, unfortunately, DC's not letting you do that.
It's true.
Because
better to be safe than sorry too, if you're a big giant corporate business.
You know what? It's like the whole political correctness thing. It's not necessary. I mean, when you have Morgan Freeman saying Black History Month stupid and shouldn't exist. Don't believe me? Go on YouTube, look up Morgan Freeman, 60 Minutes, Black History. He comes flat out, says it shouldn't exist. Why only dedicate one month when every day should be Black History Day and every be Black History Month? Because there's no White History Month, there's no Jewish History Month, there's no Asian History Month. Why limit everything to just one month for Black History? Why does it have to be just February? And it's a good point. So, why don't we take a quick break here, and we have a guest on this week. Might get a little Wild West action with him. So,
talking about Will Smith and who else was in that crappy movie? A Wild, Wild West.
Kevin Kline.
Yeah, that's it.
Who was the female lead? Was that Selma Hayek?
I think it was.
Wow.
Yeah. And Kevin Smith's giant spider in the third act.
Yeah. It was what? Kenneth Branagh as the villain?
Yep.
See, I'm pulling all remember this, that. Pulling this all out of my...
And I remember the song, and that's it. Yeah. And I saw the movie. I watched it. I just forget everything else. Like, blocked it out.
Consider yourself lucky, because most of us can't block out that bad. So that's a Batman and Robin level bad.
But you know, it's a guilty pleasure that if it's on TV, I'll stop and watch it.
There's nothing about... There's no... The word pleasure doesn't even enter into the lexicon of that movie.
Okay, so I'm guilty.
Guilty. That's all it is.
Wait, did Will Smith do a music video for that like he did for Men in Black?
Yes.
Remember the Men in Black video?
Yeah. So. He did a video for Wild Wild West, the same one.
I'm going to look it up now.
So on that note, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
don't blink and experience optical overload at the largest pop culture convention in the South. Sci-fi, comic books, anime, and more. Featuring special guests Stan Lee, Doctor Who's Karen Gillan, and Sons of Anarchy's Ron Perlman. Meet Norman Reedus, Michael Rooker, and stars from The Walking Dead. Comic book creators, costume contests, and more. April 10th through 12th, Orange County Convention Center. Get discounted tickets at megaconvention.com.
So joining us this week, writer, letterer, most people know him from lettering Figment, from doing the Marvel Universe, Ultimate Spider-Man, and Avengers Assemble. And of course, he's got coming out April 15th, his own creator-owned Wyatt Earp. It is Joe Caramagna. How are you doing this week?
I am fantastic. How are you?
Good, good. Man, it's been a while since we've talked. Last time we talked was over on the other show.
Yeah. That's right. And that was, wow, that had to be a really long time ago.
Without going back looking. Yeah.
Probably almost a year, I'd say, right? It hasn't been that
close,
long?
Close to it. Close to, wow. I'll say maybe last summer.
You just don't call, you don't write anymore to him, Mike?
Oh, no, we chat. We chat quite a bit.
He means in a formal, you know, an official capacity.
Did he even send you a Christmas card this year, Joe? Because, I mean, I'm telling you, he's been slacking this year.
I didn't get a Christmas card, no.
Oh, I didn't either, so don't feel bad.
I didn't.
No one got Christmas cards this year. Money was spent going to Colorado.
Fine. Take care of your family. Don't think about us during the holidays. It's all right, Mike.
So tell us more about Wyatt Earp, since it comes out in almost a month.
That's right, April 15th. It is a 5-issue limited series, digital first. It's called The Further Travels of Wyatt Earp. And it's basically, in a nutshell, it's Wyatt's retirement years after he leaves Tombstone and he tries to start a new chapter in his life as pretty much anything that'll bring him his fortune. He's mostly a gold miner, silver miner, wherever he goes. But he takes jobs as a saloon owner. He was racing horses for a while. And of course, no matter where he went, the law always came calling, not to arrest him, obviously, but to bring him back out of retirement to help with some problem that's been going on, mostly claim jumping and things of that nature that you run into out in the boom towns of the Wild West.
What made you decide for this project to go with Wyatt Earp?
You know, I've always been a fan of American history. Like, I've always loved it. My grandfather, my only non-Italian grandparent, because the rest of my grandparents were all born in Italy. So my one American grandparent, he's like American to the core. He passed away a few years ago. He was just, I mean, as American as you could possibly get. Like, his family was here before this was the United States. You know, like, they were colonials. So, I mean, he goes way back. His roots in this country are way back. So he was always interested in history. And when he was a little kid, he had a great uncle who was a Civil War veteran who used to tell him stories. And so he became fascinated with the Civil War. And I know it seems crazy that, like, I actually had a conversation with someone who had a conversation with a Civil War veteran. Like, that is just, it's completely crazy. But he was always into Civil War and history because of that. And I kind of picked that up from him. But, like, that's how I came to know who Wyatt Earp was. But I was never really interested in Westerns, you know, as a genre. Like, I always imagined Westerns as, you know, my other grandfather used to watch them on his small black and white TV, you know? And I'm like, yeah, okay, this isn't exactly history come to life here. So it didn't really interest me at all. And then pretty late in life, I think I was in college when one of my cousins forced me to watch Tombstone. He's like, oh, you like American history. You'll like it. You know, it's about Wyatt Earp and whatever. I'm like, all right. And I absolutely loved it. I went crazy for it. I watched it many times, but still never had any interest in Westerns. Like, I'm like, yeah, but this is, you know, this is different. This has to be different. They're all not like this, you know? And and it took, I don't know how many times that I watched Tombstone before it really hit me that at the end, you know, they have it comes up on the screen that Wyatt Earp died in Los Angeles in 1929. And I just thought to myself, like, wait a minute, like, that's kind of strange. Like, he lived all the way until 1929. Like, I figured that he would have gotten killed at some point. Like, I never really knew. I knew about the gunfight at the OK Corral, but I never really knew, like, how long he lived or how he died. I guess I assumed that he was eventually shot by somebody, like a lot of people do. They assume
like a kid or something.
Yeah, you know, like a lot of people that have come up to me have said, like, you know, I always thought that he just got killed by somebody. And I'm like, no, he died of natural causes. He was 80 years old when he died, which is crazy. And in Los Angeles, you know, that's like the golden age of Hollywood right there.
Yeah.
In 1929. Yeah. So I started to do some digging and I found out that all the stuff that happened after the gunfight at the OK Corral is as interesting, if not more interesting, than everything that led up to it. And I found out he lived in all these different places all throughout the West. You know, after he left Arizona, he went to Idaho, and he was a miner in Idaho. And then he settled in San Francisco and San Diego. And then and this really blew my mind, that he joined the gold rush in Alaska. Which I'm like, Alaska? What? Like, when you think of Wyatt Earp, you think of desert. You don't think of snow, right?
Right.
Just all these things that I was reading, and I couldn't stop. I was like eating up all this information. I just couldn't get enough of it. I'm like, this is the most fascinating life. It's crazy, all the different places he's been to and all the different things. I mean, in Alaska, he was rubbing elbows with like Jack London, and it's crazy. It boggles your mind. Right. And you realize that, like, he was a celebrity of his time. He was, like, a living legend. When he died, he was in Los Angeles working as a consultant on Westerns that were basically based on his life. So he's, like, this celebrity in the pre-internet, you know, pre-television days. So it's all word of mouth, and there's all these tall tales and legends being told about him. And he's just a guy who's trying to find some gold and make a living, you know? I just thought it was a great story. I really wanted to tell it.
Did he have like some money he lived off a celebrity and that's all he really needed?
No, he was just moving around trying to make ends meet. Like, there was no money in being a celebrity back then, you know. Like, he was a professional gambler. He owned some saloons. He was doing whatever he could to make money, right. And that's basically it.
I'm trying to wrap my head around the Alaska thing too, because I got to thinking, like, that was well before Alaska even became a United State.
That's wilderness.
Yeah, exactly. It was unexplored, probably being bickered over as to who controls it and everything like that. So it almost sounds like Wyatt still had like this thrill seeker kind of mentality to him, because he's going out into the Wild West, and then while the Wild West wasn't wild anymore, he went to the Wild North instead.
Yeah. Like, it's like when it became too tame for him, he just found whatever other untamed land he can get to. And it was Nome, Alaska. It's not like right over the Canadian border. I mean, we're talking like way out there, like near Russia, way out west in Alaska.
He might have mined with Parker Schnobel's grandfather from Gold Rush.
Wow. So that's what started the whole interest in Wyatt Earp. And then the story that you're telling is of those later years. Like, what is it, like just a couple years, or like his entire life? How much are you getting into?
Well, each chapter takes place in a different location because he moved around quite a bit. So it kind of skips around in years. The first one takes place in it's 1884. And then issue number two, we skip ahead to 1896. And the third issue is about, if I remember, I don't have it open in front of me, but it's 5 years after that. And then we really skip ahead. Had like 20 years to LA and all that fun stuff. So I kind of move around, you know, the way that Wyatt did. And each chapter is just a little glimpse into what his life might have been like in that time and place. There's some allusions to real life actual events. And there are some real people in here, you know, besides Wyatt, of course. But a lot of it is historical fiction, just me filling in the gaps of what I think happened in between these events and things of that nature.
Now, have you been in contact with any of his potential family members for, like, extra research on the stories?
Well, he had no children, officially. There have been some, there's a lot of rumors about some unofficial, you know, happenings. And I do talk about that in my book. But there are some great, great nephews and other relatives floating around, but he had no heirs, so I haven't been in contact with really anyone. And there's so many people that claim to be related to Wyatt Earp that you can't really find the real ones. You know, it would take a heck of a lot of research to figure out if someone's really related, because apparently you can make a pretty good living out west if you say that you're related to Wyatt Earp somehow.
Well, I will officially go on record and say I am not related.
Oh, I am totally not related either.
So, how did the Kickstarter end up working out for you with this project? Because I know it was all funded with Kickstarter.
Yeah, and Kickstarter, for anyone who hasn't done it, prepare yourself, because it's a really stressful experience, much more stressful than I thought it would be. Like, I jumped into it. I'm like, you know what? I have this idea. I want to see what this Kickstarter thing is all about. Why don't I just jump into it and let's see what happens? I had Scott Koblish, who's the artist, you know, I begged him for quite a long time to do this with me, and he kept resisting, but then I wore him down, and that's how I got married, incidentally. And he just drew up a few things, and I don't think that he expected it. He had some friends who tried Kickstarter, and they didn't reach their goal, so they didn't get funded, so he's just like, okay, whatever, I'll just do this for Joe, you know, as a little favor, and then it'll go away. And then we ended up getting funded. And I thought it would be great. I'm like, oh, great, you know, we can be our own bosses, and this is fantastic. No one can tell us what to do. Well, it turns out that there's 200 people that can tell you what to do. 200 people who gave you a little bit of money that added up to, you know, your goal. And I don't know if you guys are familiar with the Kickstarter, how familiar you are, but I kickstarted this thing in late 2012, and it's just finally coming out now.
Wow, yeah. Wow.
I mean, I have a few issues in the can, but it's just being released now. And that's quite a long time to wait if you kicked in, like, you know, $25 for a hard copy. And thankfully, everyone was really patient with me, and they stayed very excited through the entire process. I was sharing some sketches that Scott was doing and some behind-the-scenes stuff, you know, the art that was coming in, the pencils, the inks, and I was sharing all that fun stuff. And they stayed excited about it. They tweeted their friends about it, and they kept sending me nice, encouraging emails and stuff. But, you know, I know that through this whole thing, I know that they're thinking, like, man, when is this thing? Is it ever going to get made, or did I just throw my money away?
This is Joe's Chinese democracy right here. He's going to live off this for 20 years.
Yeah, right? You know, what is Joe doing with this $8,000 that we gave him? Is he, you know, did he run off to Vegas and or to the racetrack or something? But all these things were in my mind, and I'm like, oh God, I'm letting all these people down. But they were so great, and I'm so happy that they didn't pressure me too much, because then Scott and I would have really rushed it through, and it wouldn't have been the product that we eventually produced, which I'm so happy with. So kickstarting is really stressful. Really stressful.
I've read the preview a couple times, and everything looks awesome. I can't wait for it to come out.
Thank you so much. Yes, Scott is unbelievable. I mean, he's been doing this a really long time, so he knows what he's doing. And he, right after we kickstarted this thing, right after it got funded, he got hired to draw Deadpool, which didn't help our scheduling very much on this. So that's where a lot of the delay came in, because I kept telling him, no, you worry about Deadpool first, and then you worry about this. Like, this is a great thing for you. Go for it. And
those fans won't understand if Deadpool's late.
Yeah, no, satisfy them first. Yeah. By all means. And then, you know, he stuck with it, and he produced some really great pages for me, and I'm so happy. And now it was announced that he's the artist on the new X-Men 92 series. I don't know if you guys have heard about that.
No.
Right. It's,
missed that press.
I think they just announced it 2 days ago. It's, you know, the Marvel Infinite comics?
Yes.
Digital ones? Well, they're doing one based on the X-Men 90s animated series.
Okay.
Think of it as like Batman 66, but the 92 signifies, yeah, the animated lineup.
Right. So it's like a continuation of that animated series.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, and Scott will be drawing that, which is I'm very excited for him. I can't wait to see it.
And we've had several other people on with Kickstarter that was just basically saying that Kickstarter is this other beast that pretty much is its own job. Did you ever get like totally overwhelmed with what you needed to bring to the table for Kickstarter, or has it still maybe not hit you just yet?
No, well, I'm actually just starting to get the rewards together to mail out because I couldn't print up. Well, it's a digital first series. The only print copies I have are for the Kickstarter backers, and I couldn't print up any of the books until the first two issues were complete, because that was, you know, that's the deal for the Kickstarter. It was like a trade paperback of the first two issues together, like a collection of the first two. So I couldn't even get that thing printed until after I had everything done on the first two.
Right.
So I haven't even mailed out anything, but I did, if I can toot my own horn, I was smart enough to make a lot of the rewards digital.
Mm. Yeah.
So once I finished the first issue, I was able to satisfy a lot of the donors by sending out a digital copy of the first issue.
Oh,
and cool. I also had a lot of experiences. Like I had one where it was limited, where I had a few people do a Google Hangout with me, and they watched me while I worked, while I lettered the book, and they were asking me questions. It was people who were interested in, you know, doing their own comics and the production side of comics, and they were asking me questions, and I think I promised them an hour. We ended up staying for like over 3 hours.
Wow.
And we had a great time. Yeah, they were great. We had a lot of fun. So I did a lot of things like that. So that got a lot of people satisfied early. And now all the people who pledged to receive the print copies are kind of wringing their hands, but they're on their way shortly, and I have all the sketches. Scott sent me all the sketches. I have everything that I promised, and everything is all together. They just have to go out. So I'm just being careful not to send out too many, you know, I don't want to send it too far in advance of the book coming out, because I don't want some copies getting out there and maybe spoiling it for people and, you know, kind of shooting myself in the foot. You know, there'll be copies floating around out there, you know, 100 of them, and the book won't even be on sale yet. So
now, the next time you do a crowdfunding project, would you go back to Kickstarter, or would you go something like Indiegogo, where you would get whatever has been pledged, even if you don't meet goals?
No, I definitely wanted to do it the Kickstarter way. I didn't want people giving me money without me reaching the goal that I like set out to do. I kind of like the all or nothing thing. It's a great motivator, and you go out there and you promote like crazy. Because the problem is with Indiegogo, I would have taken the money that I made, and it wouldn't have been enough money to pay Scott to do these pages, you know, and it never would have gotten finished.
Right.
I mean, that's where all the money went. It was because I had to pay Scott, because he was basically working around the clock doing Marvel work and this, and I couldn't let him do it for free. So that, in the coloring and then producing the rewards, is where the money went to. So if I didn't reach my goal, this thing never would have gotten made. I would have liked to have, like, say, $2,000 in my pocket to do nothing, but I definitely love the challenge of it, trying to reach that goal. That was a fun part of it.
Is there anything you would change about, like, the whole Kickstarter process? Like, is there anything that you weren't happy with, or was it pretty smooth, like, besides doing, like, all the promoting and everything?
No, I mean, I was super prepared for it. I had spreadsheets going. I had, I did my research for a solid month before I launched mine, about what kind of rewards I should do, you know, the money values. Like, I studied everything, and I was super prepared, and I had a strategy for, you know, the publicity to get the word out, just to let as many people know as possible about the Kickstarter. I mean, that aspect of it, I did really well. When it came time to produce the book, I didn't do that so well, because we didn't get too much of a head start on producing the book, for a couple reasons. Like I said, Scott was extremely busy, and I don't know if he had any faith in this thing. After getting burned a couple of times, I don't think he had any faith in it. But the other thing is, like, I'm a huge hockey fan, so I believe in the jinxes. And if I went ahead and we made, like, an entire issue for free without the guarantee that we'd be able to follow through monetarily to get the thing actually made, it wouldn't have happened. Like, I'm convinced that if we had produced the first issue first before we launched the Kickstarter, that we never would have reached goal. That's right. My deranged hockey fan mind is thinking that way.
Yeah, it's so just there's nothing just about the influence of Lou Lamoriello.
Yeah, right. But there's nothing about the Kickstarter I would change. But if there was some way I could have produced the book faster, I mean, that's a different conversation, I guess. But the Kickstarter, I think, I mean, I ran that thing like a presidential campaign. I was on point for that.
So how's it been with working with digital too? Have you had like a large foray into it, or just kind of that kind of a new thing too?
No, I mean, back in 2012 it was very new. I mean, yeah. Marvel Infinite Comics were just starting up, so that's really all I knew about it. And once I got a good look at Mark Waid's Thrillbent stuff, have you guys looked at it?
Yeah,
they're very
yeah.
similar to the Marvel Infinite books. But once I saw that, I'm like, man, I only want to do digital for my own self-published work. I mean, eventually, after all five of these chapters are made, I'd like to get a nice hardcover done of it, mainly for myself to put on my shelf. But if people are interested in buying it, that would be great. But really, for my own self-published stuff, I mean, digital is the way to go. I love to read comics digitally more than print nowadays, because I can carry my entire library around with me on my iPad. And I have no problem. People complain about the experience of reading digital. I actually enjoy it quite a bit. And so, I mean, I'm all in with the digital thing. But yeah, in the beginning it was kind of new and I had to pick things up, and I worked on some of the Marvel Infinite books over the past couple of years and got used to it and asked a bunch of questions, and they probably thought I was crazy. They're like, why do you care about this, and why are you asking about that, and why are you asking about how we make books for the Kindle, like, why do you care? Because I was trying to learn for myself. And now the wider book is coming out on comics in, you know, for Comixology and on Amazon for their on their Kindle store. So because of what I learned by asking questions.
Right. Did you kind of write your series more in the kind of a mindset of like an infinite comic, where it is kind of meant to be a digital comic, or did you kind of still want that crossover when it goes to print, or what was your mindset when you're doing it?
I wrote it the way I write all my comics. I just treated it like a regular comic, and I definitely had a crossover in mind. Like, I wanted it to be suitable for print and digital. So we're kind of doing like the Batman 66 way, where the pages are sort of cut in half. And that's actually all Scott. He decided how to lay it out. Like, I wrote it, the first issue I wrote as a 14-page story, and Scott was the one who broke it up into 28 pages. Because he, you know, based on the way he wanted to lay out the book. So it's, I guess you could say it's almost a Marvel style, because he didn't really have to follow my page and panel count. He kind of did that on his own. But my script was a full script with 14 pages and, you know, all the dialogue and everything in place. But it was all Scott who decided how to break it up.
Nice. So now you've talked about, or we've talked about over on the other show, that you also do stuff for Marvel through their Marvel Universe titles.
Yep.
You can tell this group of listeners what those projects are about.
Well, basically, I adapt the comics, the Marvel Universe, Ultimate Spider-Man, and Marvel's Avengers Assemble, and now also Guardians of the Galaxy. I adapt those animated series into comics. So basically, they hand me an episode of the show, and I send them back a fully finished comic book based on that episode. which is crazy. I mean, I do all the artwork. I choose which frames of the series to use as art, and I lay out all the pages. I script it. I can't just copy what they're saying and just letter that onto the page, because I have to cut out so much from a 22-minute episode to make it fit into 20 pages of comic that a lot of the dialogue doesn't make sense anymore.
Right.
So I have to figure out different ways to, they have all their, they're giving all details of the story. Like, they have scenes where they're sitting around a table just talking, and I'm like, well, you know what? If you're looking at a comic book, you don't really want that.
Right.
So, yeah, I have to take all the important information that they say and all that exposition nonsense that they're saying around the table. Well, it's not nonsense. They're important to the plot, but, you know, it's just, there's nothing going on at the time. And I have to take all that information and kind of incorporate it into the action scenes. Okay. So I basically rewrite all the dialogue and letter it, and I send it back to Marvel with ads and everything. Like, they send me the ads, and I package the entire thing up and send it to them ready to print.
Now, without spoiling it, since you've obviously have seen it, what do we have to look forward to with the Marvel Universe Guardians of the Galaxy?
Well, let's see.
The second issue, I think, just came out this week, I think.
Yeah.
So we gotten a taste, but we haven't actually seen, like, the shows that you're basing it off of, right?
Right. I'm trying to figure out what I would be able to tell you about that.
It's a show that has Guardians.
Yeah, I very much like the movie. So if you're a fan of the movie, you'll enjoy it very much. I mean, obviously it's based on the movie more than the comic. Let's see.
How difficult is it maybe to do like a book like this, or how rare is it to do a book like this where it's coming out, it's essentially an adaption, but it's coming out before the thing that it's adapting is coming out? So that's kind of, does it feel like it's cart before the horse, or is it, you know, wasn't a big deal for you, or how did you look at it?
No, I mean, the adapted parts of them, because these issues of Guardians and these four issues, because it's only a limited series, they're half a original material and half adaptation of the episode. So the adaptation part is based on these shorts that they produced for Disney XD. I don't know if they're airing yet or when they're going to air, but that's what those backup stories are.
Okay.
And the lead stories are just based on, you know, inspired by the animated series. They haven't, you know, it's nothing that, those aren't episodes in the show.
Yeah. Okay.
But those are just original stories. Yeah. And I'm writing one of them actually right now, not as I'm talking to you, but you know, I just started my script today of my original Guardian script. It's basically the movie. I mean, that's what I'm going with in my script. I'm basing it on the voices I hear in the movie and their personalities from the movie, and that's kind of what you get in the Disney XD version.
Is the whole process, like you said, I was always a big Buffy fan growing up, and so I would have a hard time getting into the Buffy comics themselves. Because I couldn't figure out for the longest time why, and then I realized, oh wait, Buffy's got 44 minutes to get you into the story and get you out, and a comic book has 22 pages, which is not nearly as long. So I always felt like I was ripped off when I read a Buffy book. So, you know, doing that for yourself, where you have to condense all that, is it painful to throw some stuff out, or does it actually feel like it kind of gets more? You have to get more creative just to make sure you get the entire story in there in a shorter amount of time, really.
Yeah, definitely have to get creative in my story. Storytelling. A lot of times I start the comic in the middle of the episode, like right in the middle of the action, and then I kind of catch the reader up to speed with what they missed, you know, like, and just show them the fun stuff. A lot of times I can't do that because there's important stuff that happens in the beginning that they need to see. And then I end up cutting a big chunk out of the middle and skipping right to the end. so much of it has to come out, because it would be like 50 pages plus if I just did it scene by scene, and that would be painful. Plus, I don't think readers, you know, there's a lot of things that are easier to get through when you're seeing motion on your screen rather than having to read these big blocks of text. So I try to cut out as much talking as possible. I keep the talky scenes down, if I have to include them, to like one page, and then they get back to doing something. Right. You know, like if the Avengers are aboard the Quinjet talking about tracking down the Infinity Stones, that's one page. And I try to get as much information as I can, make it sound as natural as I can, and then just get out. You know? Whereas, yeah, one page, and it's probably like 2 minutes, 2.5 minutes of the episode. So that's hard to do. Like, all that talking in 2.5 minutes, if you sit there and type when there's constant talking going on, that's a lot of words.
So you've gotten to work on the Avengers, you've gotten to work on the Guardians book, the Hulk book, the Spider-Man book. Do you have who would you say is your favorite character to that you've gotten to work with on these adaptions?
Well, I've always loved Spider-Man. He's absolutely my favorite. Always has been. I'm a fan of the cartoon. I love it. I think it's funny. I love that he has his little cutaway scenes and those gags, which unfortunately a lot of times I have to cut out just because they don't really advance the plot. A lot of times they're just for comic relief, and I have no space for that. I try to keep one per issue, and it's hard because sometimes in those episodes there's like five or six of them, and they're funny. The kids love them. My kids love them. You know, they love them, that little spider, you know, L-I apostrophe L Spidey comes walking out and explains something. He has like a pointer and little diagram and he's explaining something. My son laughs and it's painful to have to take that out, but you know, the story has to make sense. So, but
gotta go.
Yeah, but I love that. I love that stuff. So, and it's unfortunately, you know, unfortunate that I have to take out my favorite parts of the episode. But Spider-Man is definitely my favorite. I love working on that.
Now, last year was a really good year for you with Marvel. Considering you were on Letterer for probably one of the top miniseries last year with Figment.
Right.
And you had probably the most sought-after book at Free Comic Book Day with Rocket Raccoon.
Yeah.
How did both of those projects come about?
Let's see. Figment, well, editor Bill Roseman, I did before he moved on to, now he works with Marvel Games, developing your favorite video games. when he was in Marvel Editorial, I worked with him a lot over the years. Like, I lettered most of his stuff. So he was doing the Disney Kingdoms books, and he just asked me if I'd be interested in doing it. And I said, heck yeah. Like, I want to work on all the Disney Kingdom books, please. Like, don't even bring it up to anybody else. I don't want anyone else even finding out about these. I want to do them all myself. So that's how that came about. Because we started out actually with the Seekers of the Weird.
Yep.
Oh. And that's when I told them, like, don't even ask anyone else. These are mine. I'm not giving them up. And that's it. So that's how Figment came about. He knew that, you know, I was going to cut him if he didn't let me letter that one. And that's how I ended up on Big Thunder Mountain Railroad too.
Okay. When an Italian says he's going to cut you, he's not playing around. That's what.
Yeah, I don't mess around. I have some years of ancestry behind me to back me up. And for the Rocket Raccoon, I was actually in Disney World. I was at Epcot in the American Pavilion.
My
phone rang and it was Marvel's number, and I looked at my wife and I was like, I don't want to answer it. I'm not taking any work calls while I'm on vacation. And she's like, just pick it up. I'm like, all right. So I answered it, and it was Mark Panisha, who's a senior editor at Marvel, and he's like, hey, I have a quick question. Would you be interested in writing the Free Comic Book Day Rocket Raccoon book? I was like, yeah. He goes, all right, I'm in a meeting. I'll talk to you later. And that was it. And I was like walking on clouds for the rest of my vacation just from that quick 1 minute conversation. Yeah, it was like the greatest thing ever. I'm like, oh, of course I would. Okay, I'm in a meeting. I'll call you back.
That was a big hit at our house. Well, Free Comic Book Day is, but you know, we like to get those kind of comics, so we were excited about that one.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm glad to hear it. I sign a bunch of them everywhere that I go. People always bring me stacks of them. That's what happens when they give it out for free.
Well, I've got 5 issues of Figment that I might be shipping up your way to get signed.
Oh, yeah, but I'm down your way pretty often, so you just wait long enough.
This is true.
Yeah, if you wait long enough, I'll show up.
But I definitely got to send them up to Toronto to get Jim signed as well.
Oh, yeah. I'm signing with Jim on Free Comic Book Day.
Uh-oh.
The day, it's technically the day after Free Comic Book Day, but it's that particular store's Free Comic Book Day celebration. They do it on Sunday instead of Saturday.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and Jim and I are both guests, so nice. It'll be my first time meeting him.
And this is going to be where?
In Escape Pod Comics.
We just had Huntington,
Long Island.
We just had Jim on the other week, so
yeah,
got a whole Figment cast and crew here on the show so far.
Well,
close.
And with Mighty Marvel Geeks, I've had Joe, I've had Jim, and I had WDI Brian Crosby, who's one of the Imagineers involved with it.
Nice.
So
now, I am interested, like, you know, I know you've gotten probably, would you say, a large portion of your work as a letterer. Kind of go through that process, because letterers don't exactly get a whole lot of the love sometimes as far as what their craft goes into. When you get something, is it just, are you kind of like trying to find the spots where you can really get creative with it, or are you just trying to make everything fit that the writer wants, or what's your kind of process as a letterer for a comic?
Well, my philosophy is to just help the writer tell the story that they want to tell, and that goes into, you know, stylistically as well. Like, I choose a font and locator captions. A lot of times I design the recap pages too. And I try to get what I think is like the tone of the book. I don't know how to explain it because there's no scientific method behind it. I just kind of look at the art and I read the script and then I just decide like how it should look in my head and I choose some fonts and just run with it. So there's really no, I mean, I guess that's a process, but there's no like science behind it or a formula or anything like that. Yeah, I'm just basically helping the writer tell the story they want to tell in the best way possible. I use a lot of storytelling in my lettering too, like my balloon placements. I try to have everything have a purpose. I don't just stick it wherever there's room, even though sometimes they force me to. They're like, you have to move that into that empty space. You're covering this or that. And I'm like, yeah, but you don't understand. but they don't care about my art at that point. They just they pay the artists a lot of money. They don't want me covering their drawings, but
no,
yeah, I just try to get across like, and different artists bring about different things. Like you have a guy like Umberto Ramos, back when I was lettering Amazing Spider-Man, Umberto has a real cartoony style, if you're familiar with his work. And, I did a lot more bursty effects where big red letters and things of that nature, you know, big screams where the outline is red and the letters are really popping out of the balloon and things like that. As opposed to, say, when I was doing Iron Man with Sal LaRocca, you know, the Matt Fraction Iron Man.
Right.
I didn't do much of that at all. Like, I tried to keep it because that artwork was more photorealistic, and I thought maybe those effects would be too cartoony for it. So it's just little subtleties like that, little decisions that you make to, I guess, you know, fit the book. Don't stand out at all. You know, some letterers want to stand out, and they have all these flashy things going on, and, like, I just try to stay out of the way. That's why I don't know how to take it when people say, oh, your lettering was great in that issue of whatever. And I never know how to take it because I'm like, well, you know, if you hadn't noticed it, then I would feel like I'm doing my job. But because you noticed it, I feel like I maybe did something wrong. Like, I don't want to, I'm not trying to draw attention to myself. I'm trying to let you lose yourself in the story.
Is that, would you say that's a kind of a common thing for most letters? Like, you feel like that's kind of the marquee is if you don't notice I'm there, then I'm doing the best job?
I guess if it would be different if I weren't working with VC, which is virtual calligraphy, that letters all of Marvel's books. So I kind of know that I have a job, you know, next month because it's, I work for a lettering studio that's contracted to do all these books. Whereas maybe someone who's doing month to month freelance might want to try to like show off their skills a little bit and stand out a little bit more to try to get the attention of potential employers, or they want to use those things as samples. So for me, it's a lot easier to say, yeah, I just want to hide and let no one notice my work because it doesn't matter to me if someone, you know, I don't need to do that. Like, I don't have to worry about getting that next gig.
Right.
So, yeah. So it's easy for me to say, but, you know.
So I'm going to assume with the being with virtual calligraphers, y'all do the lettering more digitally these days as opposed to the the old style?
It's entirely digital, yeah.
Were you ever trained in the older style, or was that pretty much already gone by the time you got into the biz?
By the time I got at Marvel, yeah, it was pretty much gone. But I did, I know how to do it. I mean, I haven't tried in years, but...
Right. That's like I studied television when I went to school, and they showed us, you know, all these things that, you know, were outdated before they got to the good technical stuff. So I didn't know if that was the same thing, same process for lettering or art or anything like that.
Well, I went to the Kubert School, and they force you to take lettering classes, hand lettering, which is fantastic because you learn a lot, not just about lettering, but you learn a lot about like art and using negative space and things like that. Because when you're a comic book artist, you have to plan for lettering to be there. So you have to plan your layouts accordingly. At least you should. Some don't, but I'm not going to go into that. that's actually how I landed a job at Marvel, because I was trained in hand lettering at the Kubert School, and I ended up on a short list somehow. I guess my lettering instructor put me on it to be an intern at Marvel because they were starting up their own in-house lettering department, and they were looking for interns to potentially train for full-time positions. And that's how I got started. I don't know. I didn't think I was particularly any good at lettering, nor was I interested in it at all. But they liked my samples, and I interviewed, and I guess they liked me enough to hire me. And on my first day on the job, they they handed me a sheet of paper and some ink pens and stuff. And they're like, all right, now letter some sound effects for samples. So I spent the whole day just lettering all these sound effects, you know, bam, and all these goofy things just on one big piece of paper. And they come around, they're like, you done? I'm like, yeah. I'm like, yeah, you're never going to have to do this anymore. We have a computer set up for you over there. That's where you'll be sitting. And that guy over there is going to show you how to letter digitally. And yeah, so thanks for coming. I'm like, okay. So I got hired based on my hand lettering skills. I had a hand letter for one day, and then that's it. Like, that was the last time I hand lettered, was then.
Like an initiation of the new guy. I mean, we're going to make him do something useless. What can we do?
Well, I think they wanted to make sure I knew how to do it. Like, they, but I didn't rely on the computer. You know, I did kind of know what I was doing. I did have some skill. And
Is it pretty common for most letterers to have art background, that degree, you know, to like the Kubrick school, or is it more, you know, not necessarily true for all letterers?
You know, people ask me this a lot. People who want to get into lettering, they're like, I don't know, you know, I'm not artistic at all, but, you know, I want to learn how to letter because it looks like it's fun. And I tell them that I don't know any letterer who's not trained in art at all. Like, there are guys who went to, you know, School of Visual Arts in New York and the Kubert School. Like, I'm a grad of the Kubert School, and Dave Sharp, who letters a lot of DC and Valiant stuff, he went to the Kubert School. We all have our Clayton Coles, who is another VC letterer. He's a Kubert School alum.
Oh. I mean, you think it's just because you know the rules of the art, so you're less likely to impede or maybe make something that shouldn't happen?
No, it's more about design. Right. You have to have like a design sense to be able to pull it off well. And I guess that's why, you know, people, Chris Heliopoulos studied like advertising art and typography. And like we kind of were trained to do the job in school, just like anyone else would train for a career in anything. And that's why I don't think people realize how difficult it is that, you know, they come up to me and say, well, you know, I don't know how to, I can't draw a stick figure, but, you know, I think if I want to work in comics, so I want to learn how to letter. I'm like, well, it's not going to be easy for you. It's not going to be as easy for you as you think. You're going to have some design sense to be able to do balloon placement and all that, and sound effects and all that stuff. It's not so easy just to learn yourself, which is why a lot of self-published books have really terrible lettering, is because the creators are like, we could save some money by not hiring a letterer because, you know, I'll just buy the font and I can do it myself. And then you look and you see like the really terrible lettering kind of makes the whole book look cheap. And we try to explain that many times, but like, if you're going to skimp, that's not the place that you want to skimp.
You know, I didn't even think about that.
The final production step isn't where you want to cut yourself short. So
I can think of a handful of like, you know, indie produced books that are just like, wow, why does this seem so weird? Oh yeah, it's because the lettering is just not kosher. It doesn't work. Yeah, and but you can't put your finger on it. You're just looking at it thinking, well, maybe it's something in the art, but it actually is the lettering. I never thought of that.
Yeah, and the art can be beautiful, and it could be a great, well-written book, and it could be colored nicely, but then when it has really ugly lettering where the balloon shapes just look off, you know, they don't look the way that you're used to seeing them, the font looks off because maybe it's the cheapest font they could find, or whatever free font was available, you know, all that stuff, it does make a difference to a reader. And like you said, you can't really put your finger on it because you're not really trained to look for it. You're just reading a comic book the way you always do, but it just looks off to you.
Yeah.
And you, as you're reading, you have that in your head, like, this doesn't, something's not right, this doesn't look right, and it kind of ruins the whole experience. So that's why I always tell people who are self-publishing or doing their own indie books, I'm like, hire a professional letterer. Not me, doesn't have to be me. I'm not trying to get work for myself, I'm just giving you advice.
But
hire a letterer
who
knows what they're doing, because I can't do it anyway because of the Marvel contractual stuff. But
so note to self, open up a book, see copper plate, put it down.
Hey, I use copper plate very often, so it's not the font, it's how you use it. That's what I always say. I actually challenged myself. I got Comic Sans into a Marvel book without anybody noticing. What else did I do? Papyrus, I put into a book with nobody even saying a word. word to me. Nobody even noticed. And because I was trying to say that it's not necessarily the font. It's how you use the font and where you use it. And if it's blending into the story, you're not going to notice it. It's not going to stand out to you. Like Comic Sans stands out because you go to work and they put up like, please wash hands in Comic Sans next to the sink. Then yeah, you see it and you're like, oh God, that looks terrible. But when used appropriately, like when something is supposed to look bad, for example, then no one even notices. And they're like, oh, that's great. So it definitely how you use it. And it's funny because I lettered The Incredible Hercules a few years ago for Greg Pak and Fred Van Lente.
Right.
Do you guys remember that series? It was after the World War Hulk stuff.
Right.
Some of that was the stuff that was on the 99 cent sale this past Monday, wasn't it?
Yeah, you're right. It's true. And I lettered that whole run. And then a couple months go by and I see Greg Pak tweeting something about the font Papyrus, how bad it is and how hacky it is. And I said, Greg, you know I use Papyrus and Incredible Hercules, right? He goes, what? You did? And then like an hour later, he tweets me like, oh yeah, I see it. And he like left to go look through the issue to see where I used Papyrus. I used it very often in Incredible Hercules. I used it for the locator captions. And he never even noticed just because of the presentation. So,
well, as Uncle Ben once said, with great font comes great responsibility.
Oof. That's
is there one font that you haven't been able to make work yet that you're just itching to use? Is there one that's just kind of sitting on the back burner on the batter's box?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Yeah. No. I mean,
you know, there's like that great American novel that most writers always have. Is there like that great American font that a letterer hasn't been able to put into a book yet?
No, I don't know. But going back to Copperplate, I use it in Wired Earth actually. So there you go. Yeah. And because it suits how I use it, it doesn't really stand out negatively. So
yeah, most of the time I've seen it, it's been used with sports logos and sports teams, and it's always used wrong.
Yeah, always.
Not going to mention team names, St. Louis Blues, but... where can they find you on the internet?
I am on Twitter at Joe Caramagna, which is a very tough spell. I'll spell it, but you can also check in the credits box of, you know, 1 out of 4 of your Marvel comics. it's Joe, and Caramagna is Caramagna, and that's the best place to get me because I'm always on there throughout the day. I use Twitter as my reward for finishing my work on time.
And there's a lot of...
Oh, good. I got done early. Now I can check TweetDeck, and I pop it open.
And there's always great conversations, Joe, on Twitter.
I don't know about that. Maybe if you like donuts, hockey... Nothing
too deep. We do like hockey and we do like donuts, so I think you got a new follower there. Are you going for the are you a Devils fan and being from in that area?
I am a huge Devils fan.
So how you feeling about this year?
Oh, it's a terrible year.
are you even watching anymore?
I am. I still watch like this is my playoffs. You know, like let's just try to ruin it for someone else. Get in there. You know what I do? I watch the games now. And I realize they're out of it, so I just sit there and scream for them to like take somebody's head off. I'm like, you're out of it, just knock them out. Especially when they play a rival, I'm like, just drop the gloves, knock them out. Dirty, who cares, your season's over.
Yesterday
play with some passion.
Yesterday being St. Patrick's Day, they wore the best jerseys they've ever had.
Yes. Oh, I look forward to that every year when they do the retro night for St. Patrick's Day.
Yeah.
Oh, it's my favorite.
What used to be nicknamed the Christmas jersey.
Yeah, well, they used to be much brighter. Did you notice last night they were very dark green?
Yeah, I saw that they went with the darker green.
Yeah, it's almost black, actually. It's like very, very dark green.
Yeah, I was disappointed with that. I missed the Kelly. I mean, because it was more of a Kelly green.
Yeah. It's definitely, in the past, was much brighter. And I had a jacket that was like super green when I was a kid. you could see me coming for miles. My big green Devil's jacket with the big red logo on it.
Yep.
It's terrible. But you know what? That's kind of how I got into hockey, is because coming from an Italian family, they're like, oh, look, they wear the Italian flag colors. I'm like, yeah, that's right, Mom. Take me to a game.
So are you a member of the 300?
No, I was too young.
From the Blizzard game?
Yeah. Okay. No, I was too young for that. Yeah. I was way too young to drive myself, and there was no way my dad was going to take me there. I think the first Devil's game I ever went to, I wasn't really a fan until like 88, 89. The first game I went to was before I had any interest in it, when I saw them play against one of the Soviet teams. When they came over, they did that tour across North America playing against the NHL teams, and they destroyed the Devils.
That was before the Olympics or after the Olympics? I'm trying to remember. I think I remember hearing
You mean the 1980 Olympics you're talking?
No, it was just, wasn't it like a tune-up game that they were basically doing, or was it just a Goodwill game?
I thought it was just a Goodwill thing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I want to say it was like the 80s.
Yeah, they're talking about that with that Russian team, and they would play some NHL teams. But I can't remember for sure if that was before or after the Olympics that happened.
But you had the Russian Penguins. I remember that was one of the teams. I think
the Dynamo Moscow.
Yeah, the Moscow Dynamo.
Dynamo Riga. Let's see how many we can name, Mike. This is a fun thing. I can't even think of any more.
Teams from back then or teams now?
No, teams from back then. You're talking like Slava Fetisov and Igor Larionov.
Well, you had Red Army.
Red Army, yes.
You had the Penguins. You had Moscow Dynamo. You had the gimmick.
That's right. You looked it up, didn't you? You Googled
No, I did not.
I'm watching his eyes right now. He's coming up from his brain because it's smoking right now.
Metalurge.
No, that's one. That was one.
What?
Yeah.
I can't rebuff you because I don't know for sure, but that does not sound like an actual team.
Sounds like a German band.
No, there's a team called the Metalurge.
or a magazine from the rack for metal bands.
You also had Tractor. I'm sure
those teams, they didn't make it over to North America for that tour.
No. They didn't make it over for that tour, but I remember keeping up with having Ukrainian heritage. I kept up with the Russian teams quite a bit.
Yeah, I was a terrible American. I thought the Soviets were so cool.
They had that one jersey.
About politics, but I used to draw that little hammer and sickle on my notebooks. they're so tough.
But there was the that one Soviet jersey that's featured by Randall in Clerks.
Yeah,
that was like the greatest Soviet jersey ever, outside of the traditional Olympic jersey.
Do you have any of those, the Russian team jerseys?
Not from back in the day. No, I wish.
Man, I've always wanted one of those. Yeah,
I wanted one of the Russian Penguins, which coincidentally the penguin looks very similar to what Scranton Wilkes-Barre uses for their logo.
Isn't that what the Penguins used to use? Isn't that the same penguin? Because I always thought it was a ripoff of the Pittsburgh Penguins.
The Penguins,
like the old style. No,
they helped fund the team.
Oh, did they?
Yeah, there was like a partnership of some sort with the Penguins, which is why they went with the penguin look. But the penguin is very similar to what, when Scranton Wilkes-Barre was announced, it's very similar to what they went with there in the beginning.
Very interesting. It's much more interesting than talking about Wyatt Earp, actually. I can talk about hockey all night.
So really, Joe, when is your hockey comic book going to come out? Because I think we can get on board with that one, too.
Oh, I wish.
Do
you remember when a few months ago, or was it last year, that Stan Lee did the hockey teams, reimagined as superheroes or whatever, the mascots?
That was a while back. That was around 2010.
Oh, see, I just woke up from a four-year nap. So. 2010. Wow.
Yeah, because they did one with the Thrashers. That was right. Oh. Being the Thrashers fan I was at the time.
Yeah, that was one of those of there was some really good hits with it, but there was a lot of misses in that as far as making it look cool.
Yeah.
or hitting with the kids. I think the kids were like, I'm gonna go play with my Game Boy now.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Marty, are you a Nashville Predators fan?
I am. And then we're very excited here because we're actually winning, so it's kind of nice.
Well, you were winning.
Well, yeah, that's true. So for the last 10 games, we've been doing really good this season. I don't know what kind of yips we've been getting here lately, but hopefully we'll knock it out by playoff time and actually have a run at it this year. It'd be great.
The Wild picked up another savior goalie.
Ugh.
So that's helping.
The Wild are already on our list just because they stole Suter from us a couple years back. So I think they've got our old general manager as well. So there's all these connections to the Wild, and then when they beat us, then we really hate it because it's like, hey, you took all our best guys.
Yeah. What I love about the Wild though is that they have so many guys from Minnesota on their team.
True.
It's by design. Like I love that. I wish New Jersey. Well, New Jersey has some good players that are from here. Not the Devils, but you know, the NHL. The NHL has good players from New Jersey, like James Van Riemsdyk and Bobby Ryan.
Mm-hmm. And I think wasn't it a recent article about a kid that wrote to a GM or the commissioner or something like that, asking them to trade her dad back to Minnesota so that the dad could be home more with the kids and the family.
Yeah, that was Leopold.
It was a Minnesota player, right?
He was traded to Minnesota now. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I don't remember where he got traded from.
East Coast somewhere, I think. I want to say Carolina.
Was it Buffalo? It wasn't Buffalo.
Could have been.
It was somewhere terrible, wasn't it?
Yeah. It was actually beneficial.
New Jersey, but
hey, I need to get off this team and get in the playoffs. You know, hey, write this heartfelt letter and get me out of this sinking ship.
Columbus. He was with Columbus.
Oh yeah. Okay. So yeah. It wasn't a terrible team. It was just a team that had a lot of injury problems. That's why they were terrible. But I feel bad for Jules. She's not involved at all. Jules, are you a Pittsburgh Penguins fan?
I want to be, if that counts. I just never got into hockey. I don't know why. I've always loved football, and I love baseball. I like the Pirates. They, you know, not my favorite sports, but hockey, I feel like, I think I talked with the guys about this before. I feel like I would love it, but it would be like an obsession because it's so like violent and it's so like, it's like fast paced and everything. It's like baseball, you can kind of sit there and just like zone out.
you just need to wait for the crybaby to leave town.
And I'll tell you, this city, like I'm from Ohio, so I grew up around Browns fans. And so then living in Pittsburgh, of course, oh my goodness, this city, and I live like 10 minutes from downtown Pittsburgh. This city is just very dedicated to the Pittsburgh Penguins. Pirates too, but I see it more with the football team and the Penguins. I see it a lot with Penguins. So it's like an obsession here. It's like crazy town here. It's a really, really dedicated fan base. So.
I will say there is one place worse, and that's Denver when it comes to the football team.
Oh.
If it's a home game, if it's a Sunday when the team's playing, or it's a Monday evening, it's like you might as well go ahead and shut everything down.
That's Green Bay too.
Yeah,
Green Bay doesn't have any other sports options.
Exactly,
it's only the Packers.
I've heard if you go, the city is tiny. It's you know, if they hadn't gotten a team when they did, they never would have gotten a team. You know, probably 10 years after that, because just the way the sport grew and the cities grew. But I mean, they were smart. They got it publicly funded, and they're there to stay for life.
Yep. So, well, we're not going to keep you too much longer, Joe. We thank you for coming on this week and talking about Wyatt Earp and a little puck talk. That could almost be.
I told you
that could be a podcast.
I could talk about it all night. Oh yeah, I can talk about hockey all night. I'll stay as late as you want for that. Wyatt Earp's pretty okay too, I guess.
What if you had Wyatt Earp playing hockey? Then
oh, stop! Throw some donuts in there, and that's my favorite stuff all in one. He's playing with a donut puck. Oh, my head's gonna explode.
That sounds like you'd be playing against Homer Simpson or something there.
Yeah, the only thing that would make it better is if it was a cronut.
Do you even have those by you, cronuts?
Yeah, at Epcot, if you remember what used to be the McDonald's restaurant, that quick service restaurant by the merchandise shop that you come into World Showcase, they sell cronuts there.
Really?
Yeah.
What is a cronut? I don't know.
Right.
A donut?
We're going to be here for another half hour. Here we go. Talking about cronuts now.
Cronut is a cross between a donut and a croissant.
Oh.
It's quite delish, Jules.
Delightful.
Just go find one. You'll thank us later.
It's about far from New York City? You can get one, like an original cronut. That's how far of a drive is that? Like 6 hours?
Yeah. Flying, I think, when we flew, it was like 45 minutes, I think. So that's, but it's super expensive. So I'd have to drive.
Oh, man.
I'm sure there's one somewhere there in Pittsburgh.
There probably is. I don't know. Well, there was a Krispy Kreme. For some reason, donut shops don't last around here. There was a Krispy Kreme donut shop that closed. Like, it wasn't even there for, I don't even think, a year. And then right by where we live, there's a Dunkin' Donuts. I think that's only been there, like, maybe a year, maybe two. It's fairly new. So, like, Dunkin' Donuts, I think, is, like, the ones that are around here. We have one that's like a Mon Pa donut shop.
Those are the best.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're only open, like, I don't know, like maybe 6 to 12 or something. So.
Oh, then you know those donuts are good.
is that the place down near Point Park?
No. Is there, I don't know if there might be one down there. I don't know. I haven't been down that way in a while. I avoid downtown at all costs if I possibly can, but I love it down there. It's just like, I just try to avoid it because it gets so, especially around like 5 o'clock, it gets really, 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 really busy and crazy. And I actually went to Point Park for a year. It's kind of funny. So I don't know, but it was years ago when I went, but it might be. There's a donut shop I just heard of. It's called Peace, Love, and Little Donuts around here. And I guess they make teeny tiny like donuts. And when they give you your box of donuts, it's like a teeny, teeny, tiny box of donuts. So like 50 of them or something. Like, it, yeah, someone told me about it. And I was like, nah. And they're like, yeah, they really give you this like little tiny box of donuts because they're real little. And I was like, wow. That sounds like fun.
When I was a kid, my mom used to take me to the flea market and they had, like you said, these teeny tiny donuts, and you could actually watch them being fried like in front of you. It was like this conveyor belt of grease that they would come floating by, and then they had this flipper thing, this little mechanism that would like flip them over and cook on the other side. And then by the time they made it all the way around, they would toss them in a bag full of powdered sugar and just shake it up and hand it to you. And it's like, oh, these are the best things ever. And they were tiny. They're little tiny little donuts. So good. But like, if that mom and pop shop can make rent and only stay open from 6 to 12, those things have to be good. You have to go get them.
Yeah.
And then report back to me. Because I need to know.
Well,
I've actually made my own donuts, but they don't last very long around here. I bought like a donut pan, and I think for like $12, so because I thought it was gonna be like a lot more, and then just looked, like, Googled, or I think I have a cookbook that had a few in, and then it was really bad. And after I made the donuts, I think they were we did like pumpkin ones, and then I did like, after they came out of the oven, you dip them in butter, and then you put, kind of like you were saying with the bag of sugar, you get like cinnamon sugar and you mix it up and you put that in it and you shake it up, and then you eat it right away. You have to eat it right away, though, like after you mix it, because then it's like warm. Oh my gosh. Yeah. I was fried after I ate that. I was like, this is so, it was so rich, because it wasn't fried or anything, but it tasted like it was like death. It was so good.
So, I have a donut maker that's like a waffle iron, where it has all the little rings in it. You lift it up, you pour your donut batter in there, and you close it up, and then the light like turns green when it's done, and you just lift it up and pull them out. And my kids, they make me make them donuts like every weekend. I love them. Yeah, I make chocolate chip donuts.
Sounds like my family and pumpkin chocolate chip cookies.
Oh,
what?
Pumpkin chocolate chip cookies. It's pumpkin cookies, chocolate chip.
It's good if you did a muffin too. Pumpkin. I did a pumpkin chocolate chip muffin before, and those are really good.
Can I trade you guys comics for those?
Any chat.
Mike, you really want those Figment comics signed?
What was that? 40% at Disney?
Send me the Figment books along with some pumpkin cookies, and I'll send you back signed Figment books and some crumbs.
Because I'm not guaranteed to have chocolate chip fingerprints on top of your books as well. Yeah. So he was enjoying them while signing.
Now, since we're on the topic of foods and things, and these delicious cookies that you guys make yourself, like, my birthday's coming up on March 30th, and every year for my birthday, no, I'm not trying to get you guys to send me food. Every year on my birthday, my wife orders me deep dish pizzas from Chicago. We haven't delivered from Chicago, a whole bunch of them. We invite family and friends over, and we have these deep dish pizzas. Uh-huh. And this year, for my dessert, I went online, and I custom made my own ice cream flavor, and those are being delivered too.
Wow.
Yes.
How do you get them? How do you get them delivered from Chicago to your place?
They're frozen. Well, they're okay. Yeah, they're like prepared raw, and then they freeze them and you just pop them in the oven for like 45 minutes.
That's pretty cool.
so good. Oh, it's incredible. Yeah. Plus, it comes with dry ice, which is always fun. Like, you open up the box and the house is all foggy. It's great. but the ice cream flavor that I created for my birthday, and I call it my Chicago style birthday when I send out the invitations. That's what it's like, Joe's annual Chicago style birthday. And you can name these flavors of ice cream anything you want. So the name of the ice cream is Joe's Chicago style birthday. It's a cheesecake flavored ice cream with graham cracker crumbs and chocolate chunks.
Oh. Wow.
Yes, thank you. Just figured I'd brag a little bit.
Will this be the first time you sampled this then, this creation?
First time, yes.
Okay, so you haven't even had it yet to know, to report back that this is the greatest creation in all of ice cream.
No, but it's good or bad, it's the official flavor of Joe's Chicago style birthday. Because because they charge you a lot of money to have that printed on the side of the carton.
So now can anybody order that, or is it just like do they have like a store where you can just say, oh look, and just like order that, or is it just like just custom?
Oh, you can do both. It's, I don't know if I want to give them a free plug, but I'll let you know what it is. If you don't mind, I'll tell you. I don't care. Yeah. But no, it's a place like you can choose one of their pre-mixed flavors, or you can just select your own. You get to pick your base, which you can create a sorbet or an ice cream or a gelato, and they have all these mix-ins for it, all these different flavors.
Awesome.
Yes. Well, and they have contests on there too, that you can submit your custom made flavor into a contest, and then I think they make that available for sale or something. I don't know.
Before we get derailed too much longer, again, we thank you, Joe, for coming on. And
we passed that point. Yeah,
we digressed long ago.
You can edit all this out, right?
He can. I don't know if he will, but he can.
All right.
So, depends on Mike's fickle mood at the time.
So, on that note, if Jules or Marty, if you guys don't have anything.
I'm good.
Okay. So
I learned all I can about Joe, and I appreciate it. Now I want to go eat ice cream and donuts, so thanks.
Have that effect on people.
So, on that note, until next week.
You owe me for one jelly donut!
The bad crowd you've been hanging out with is a science fiction club?
This has been a Weeby Geeks production.